John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for October 27th through November 2nd, 2012. As Palestinians mark the 95th anniversary of Balfour Declaration this week, Israeli attacks targeting the Gaza Strip and the West Bank left one killed and four others injured. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the non-violent activities organized in the West Bank. Israeli troops used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to suppress Friday's protests. IMEMC's Salam Kumsiya has the story.
Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation when troops attacked the weekly anti-war protests at the village of Kfar Kadum in northern West Bank. Villagers were joined by their international and Israeli supporters after midday prayers. As soon as protesters reached the roadblock at the village entrance, Israeli forces stationed there attacked them using tear gas and forced them back into the village. In the central West Bank, anti-war protests were organized at the villages of Be'alin, Na'alin, and Nabi Saleh. At a Nabi Saleh village, Israeli troops attacked the villagers and their supporters before they left the village to get to lands Israeli took to build the wall and a new settlement on. Troops forced people back into the village and later invaded Nabi Saleh. Soldiers fired tear gas into residents' homes. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation, mostly women and children. In Bil'in and Na'alin, villagers and their Israeli and international supporters managed to reach the Israeli wall built on lands taken from local farmers. Israeli soldiers stationed fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at protesters. At the village of Na'alin this week, protests ended with clashes between local youth and Israeli troops. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation, but no injuries were reported. Also on Friday, at the village of Al-Ma'asara, southern West Bank, Israeli troops stopped the weekly anti-war and settlements protest at the village entrance and forced people back into the village using gravel butts and batons. No injuries were reported. For IMEMC News, this is Salam Kumsi.
Palestinians Palestinians inside the occupied Palestinian territories and in the diaspora marked on Friday the 95th anniversary for the notorious historical Declaration of Balfour, a statement by the British colonialism minister of 1917 in which he promised a national home for Jews worldwide in historical Palestine. This and more by IMEMC's Rami Al-Maghari.
Salim Zanoun, head for the Palestinian National Council, called on world nations to lift an oppression Palestinians have endured since November 2, 1917, when a Great Britain by then promised Jews worldwide to establish a national homeland for them in Palestine. Zanoun asserted that the international community should be held responsible for the ongoing Palestinian plight. He called for supporting a Palestinian move at the UN aimed at gaining UN recognition of Palestine as a non-member state. Meanwhile, Palestinian politician Wasila Abu Youssef told Palestinian Ma'ani News Agency this week that some European countries have conditioned a vote on the UN-based Palestinian move with restoration of stalled peace talks with Israel. In the meantime, by November 13 this month, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will meet at the Arab States League in Cairo with representatives of Arab and European countries ahead of going to the United Nations to submit the recognition request. On a different note, Palestinian media outlets reported that Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is planning to visit the Gaza Strip with an attempt to break international isolation of the Hamas-ruled Gaza. Erdogan is said to plan to invite Palestinian president to join him. This is the second visit for a high-ranking international official to Gaza, following last month's visit by Emir of Qatar, Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, who laid the foundations for some vital Qatar-funded infrastructure projects. Both Qatar and Turkey had intervened to reconcile between Abbas and Hamas, but both are yet to agree. For IMEMC News, I am Rami Al-Maghari in Gaza.
Israeli bombardment targeting Gaza continued this week. One man was killed and four others injured as a result of those attacks, while in the West Bank, Israeli troops continued their invasions and arrests of Palestinian civilians. IMEMC's Ghassan Bannoura with the details.
On Sunday at dawn, the army assassinated Sulaiman Al-Karra, 27, a member of Al-Qassam Brigades, and wounded another resident in an airstrike that took place as fighters clashed with soldiers invading an area east of Khan Yunis. The Israeli Air Force carried out late on Sunday evening at least four airstrikes targeting different areas in the Gaza Strip, causing excessive damage. One injury was reported. In another attack, one resident was wounded on Monday morning after being hit by a fragment of a missile fired by the Israeli Air Force into an agricultural land in Al-Karama area, northwest of Gaza City. Later in the week, Palestinian medical sources in the Gaza Strip reported Friday that one resident was seriously injured by a shell fired by the Israeli army into Johar ad-Dik area in central Gaza. Israeli soldiers killed over the last week 9 Palestinians and wounded at least 14 others, some seriously, in a series of airstrikes and bombardment targeting the coastal region. From its part, Al-Qassam Brigades this week fired similar mortars at Israeli targets across the borders with Gaza. The brigades issued a press release stating that the firing of the shells comes in retaliation to the ongoing Israeli military escalation against the coastal region. The shells caused damage but no injuries, Israeli sources reported. In the West Bank this week, Israeli military invasions were focused around Hebron and Bethlehem cities in the south and the cities of Ramallah and Nablus, central and northern West Bank. During these invasions, at least 20 Palestinian civilians were arrested by the Israeli soldiers. Elsewhere, Hala Abu Aisha, 11 years old, was injured on Wednesday when an Israeli settler rammed her near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. According to local sources, Abu Aisha was hit by a settler near the Jerusalem-Hebron road. She was moved to a hospital after sustaining critical wounds, local sources added. Meanwhile, the Israeli military freed this week Hassan al-Safadi, 33 years old, after spending 10 years under military administrative detention. Al-Safadi went on hunger strike earlier in the year for 93 days, then went back and did 73 days of hunger strike when the army refused to release him in July and extended his detention for additional 6 months. As-Safadi was welcomed with celebrations by his family and friends at his hometown Nablus, northern West Bank. In other news, the Israeli human rights group Peace Now reported on Monday of this week that the Israeli state has approved 180 settlers' housing units to be built in illegal settlements inside occupied East Jerusalem. According to Peace Now, the houses will be dedicated to soldiers and police officers. Moreover, later in the week, the Israeli military demolished 3 Palestinian homes. One home was leveled at the village of Beit Umar near Hebron and 2 in the West Bank city of Jericho. The army claimed that the homes are built without the needed permission. For IMEMC News, this is Ghassan Barnoura.
And that's all for today from This Week in Palestine. This was the weekly report for October 27th through November 2nd, 2012, from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, George Rishmal.
Afghanistan, 1st of November. 4 Norwegian soldiers were wounded when their armored vehicle hit a roadside bomb in northern Afghanistan. They were part of a column of 7 vehicles with 25 troops underway from Mazar-e Sharif to Kabul when their SISU was destroyed by the bomb. Afghanistan, 30th of October. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from a non-combat related injury in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 30th of October. 2 British soldiers were shot and killed by a man in an Afghan army uniform in yet another of the insider attacks that have smashed NATO's strategy of trying to hand the war off to Afghan puppets. These attacks have killed at least 53 occupation troops as of the 30th of October. Afghanistan, 30th of October. Unidentified armed men opened fire on an oil tank truck, killing one person and injuring 2 others in Dushi district of Baghlan province. The oil tank truck burned to the pavement. Pakistan, 2nd of November. An unknown gunman opened fire on a gas station, killing 8 people and wounding dozens in Khuzdar. The entire gas station, a passenger van, a rickshaw, and 2 motorbikes were burned to the ground in the resulting fire. Mr. Barack Obama, this just goes on and on. Now's the time to throw in the towel, bring all the troops home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. The D.C. area caught an incredible break with Hurricane Sandy. The storm path was just far enough north, going up Delaware Bay rather than the Chesapeake Bay, that we were spared the worst. Other places were not so lucky. Atlantic City got hammered. The homes of the poor were flooded, while the homes of the wealthy and the casinos were untouched. New York City had catastrophic damage. Subway tunnels filled with water. 80 homes burned, homes of police and firefighters, because nobody could get equipment in the storm. In less than a decade, 2 American cities have been devastated by Katrina-style storms, no thanks to global warming, no thanks to the coal, oil, and gas industries. As this is being recorded, Occupy Wall Street activists and other activists are setting up a relief operation in New York City, offering better food than FEMA does, following the same pattern that was followed by the Common Ground Medical Collective in Algiers, New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. It's This time we were lucky. Next time we might not be. With superstorms like Katrina and Sandy becoming a reality of life in a world of global climate change.
In the wake of a one-of-a-kind hurricane merged with a nor'easter storm that smashed into the East Coast on October 29th, the issue of climate change is now front and center, at least among those who consider the strange and extreme weather the world has been experiencing the past year or two to be linked to climate change. What's happening is exactly what 98% of the world's climate scientists predicted would happen. It's just happening much sooner than many thought it would. Before Hurricane Sandy, the climate change group 350.org had already planned what it's calling their Do the Math tour starting November 7th, the day after the presidential election. With both President Barack Obama and challenger Mitt Romney trying to outdo each other in support of fossil fuel extraction, 350.org founder Bill McKibben says the time is right to promote the conclusion he reached in his recent article in Rolling Stone magazine. That known reserves of oil, coal, and gas hold five times more carbon than climate scientists think is safe to burn. Organizers hope their 21-city Do the Math tour will spark a nationwide fossil fuel divestment campaign at colleges and universities and inspire new protests against the industry. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Daniel Kessler, media campaigner with 350.org, about the tour and the divestment campaign, which will include a video appearance by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, urging people to join the new movement based on the divestment model that helped to end apartheid in South Africa.
We're launching our Do the Math tour the day after the election. It's on November 7th, and there's some symbolism behind that. We're looking kind of outside the political process because the political process isn't moving at the speed that we need it to. So we're going to be pointing some of our energies directly at the fossil fuel industry, and that's why we're launching this tour. Going to be going to 21 cities in about 25 days. It's going to be going at breakneck speed. And the point of it is to go around and kind of talk to people about the math behind the climate crisis, where, you know, how much warming we can actually take on this planet, how much carbon we have left to burn, and how much carbon reserves the fossil fuel industry currently has. And when you look at the numbers, they currently have about five times in their reserves what we can burn if we want to stay below a safe level of temperature rise.
What does 350.org consider a safe level of temperature rise?
You know, every country, including the United States, came together in 2009 in Copenhagen, and they all agreed that 2 degrees was the red line. That was the number, that's 2 degrees Celsius. That's the number that we don't want to go beyond. And we've already raised the Earth's temperature about 0.8 degrees Celsius, so we're almost halfway there.
Your campaign points to the fossil fuel industry as the enemy. What are you focusing on?
Oil, gas, and coal. And the reason for it is that, you know, the atmosphere doesn't really discriminate when it comes to fossil fuels, that we actually need to stop burning all of them and transition to renewable energy as soon as we can. And so those companies have been responsible for, you know, buying off our politicians, making sure that we can't see progress in this country. And, you know, we're seeing the effects of what burning their product, their carbon product, is on our climate. And, you know, most people just poke their head outside their window this year and they've seen some of the crazy extreme weather that's going on. We broke 3,100 temperature records in June. We're now experiencing the 330th consecutive month where the average temperature has exceeded average norms. And so things are getting crazy, and people are seeing that, and we know who's responsible for it. It's the fossil fuel companies.
And Daniel Kessler, what's your strategy? Divestment? Boycott?
Right, we're launching a divestment campaign, and it's based on what happened in with the anti-apartheid movement in the 80s. Where students really rose up on campus and said that it's immoral for their money to be wrapped up in companies that are investing in South Africa. And we're going to be launching a similar model, essentially saying that it's immoral for school endowments to have their money wrapped up in fossil fuel companies, the same companies that are kind of baking the planet for these students are going to have to inherit. So, no, we're not asking people to boycott. That wouldn't be very effective. And yes, of course, we all do use fossil fuels. But the question is when we're going to transition off them and what are the obstacles to doing that? And the fossil fuel companies, you know, have an incentive to keep us hooked on their product, and they've done a very good job with that. And this effort around divestment is going to be a way to push back.
So this is a totally campus-focused tour?
No, we're going to some universities and some cities. And, you know, one of the campaigns that we're going to be really focusing on next year is on this divestment work, but it's by no means the only campaign we'll be running. We'll be doing lots of stuff that's aimed at the fossil fuel industry and kind of attacking their social license to operate, essentially saying that their business model is predicated on cooking the planet, and that needs to stop.
Neither Romney nor Obama has raised climate change in this campaign. And alas, not one of the moderators for the vice presidential debate or the three presidential debates have mentioned it. What does that say to you?
Well, you can interpret that in a lot of different ways. I've been thinking about it in two ways. One is that it's clear the fossil fuel industry has, in some respects, got what they've been trying to do, which is silencing our politicians and our voices around this and stifling dissent and making sure that there's a lot of misinformation out there. And the candidates, you have to say that it's kind of a moral failing on their behalf that they haven't addressed the climate crisis. But the other way I've been looking at it is from an electoral standpoint. And the polls show that people want a transition onto renewable energy, onto clean energy, and off of fossil fuels. So any politician who takes that challenge on would probably see a benefit from it. So it's quite mysterious why neither candidate will address the climate challenge.
You mentioned this is just one of the campaigns 350.org is working on. Can you say anything about other campaigns?
Well, we're going to be doing a lot of stuff, but you know, most people are probably familiar with our efforts to stop the Keystone XL pipeline from coming down from Canada to the Gulf Coast. And that decision, you know, the president hasn't decided yet what the fate of that pipeline is going to be, and that's sort of our number one political ask. It's putting enough pressure on the president that makes him understand that the people don't want this pipeline, and he must say no to it. So there'll be a lot of action around the pipeline. We're also doing a number of things internationally and lots of other campaigns in the states that we're not quite yet ready to disclose, but I think people are going to think are really exciting.
That was Daniel Kessler, media campaigner with the climate change group 350.org. Find more information on the Do the Math tour on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Here is an update on the ongoing blockade of construction of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline in Texas. The Trees Hit and other direct actions have been blocking TransCanada's construction of the southern leg of the pipeline for 41 days as of the 2nd of November. Cops and off-duty cops working for TransCanada have turned the Trees Hit into a fortress under siege. They cannot reach the sitters by bucket truck, so instead they are again attempting to starve them out. Their first attempt failed after 50-plus protesters stormed the easement in October to resupply the tree sitters. Now they've been resupplied again, thanks to the efforts and sacrifice of Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. Here is a statement she released over YouTube before resupplying the tree sit and being arrested as a result.
I'm Jill Stein. I'm the Green Party candidate for president, and it is such an honor to be here at the site of the tar sands blockade here in Winnsboro, Texas. And I am really honored to be able to support the efforts of the tar sands blockade. And I feel like I have to be here. There's no more important place to be, especially in the wake of the superstorm Sandy. And I'm here as a mother. I'm here as an American. I'm here as a citizen of the planet to stand up for our children, our grandchildren, for all of us, really, because we are all in the target hairs right now of these horrendous policies being promoted by both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. In fact, Barack Obama has embraced the drill, baby, drill policies of George Bush and gone much further, opening up offshore oil, opening up our national parks, giving the green light to the Keystone pipeline and the construction of the first half of it, giving the thumbs up to fracking, undermining the international climate accords. It's time to stand up with the politics of courage, with the vision of courage, like what's going on here at the Keystone XL blockade. It's so important that we stand up in our actions, out in the street, here in the forest, as it's that alliance of a social movement on the ground, together with an independent and courageous political voice that has always moved us forward during the abolition movement, during women's struggle for the right to vote, during the labor movement.
We always had a social movement on the ground, like what's going on here today, like the Occupy movement, like the student strikes to block the tuition hikes. We have that social movement. We need to also make this a political movement as well. The clock is ticking. We don't have time to wait. This is the time to stand up. And I just want to thank so much the people here who are leading the way for us all, who really should be our models, our profiles in courage for how we move forward to a peaceful, just, green future that we deserve and that is within our reach right now.
On the 30th of October, one of the tree sitters released this statement about what it's like up in the trees defending the forest and the earth from the rapacious greed of TransCanada and their tar sands oil pipeline.
I know there's been a lot said about us tree sitters up here. Both people who are explaining what we're doing and defending us, and people are saying all sorts of stuff about us up here. So I just want to say a few things in my own words, because I'm actually up here. It's kind of hard when my entire social circle has largely revolved around law enforcement officers and TransCanada workers with cameras in my face all the time. I just want to say that I am tired of the bullshit. I am tired of TransCanada's bullshit. They talk so much about, you know, calling us all sorts of labels. But I just want to say that I'm out here trying to make my Sunday school teachers proud. I am here treating my neighbor as myself, loving my neighbor as myself. If TransCanada was your neighbor, would you want them to do this to your land? Want them to take your land when you don't want them to take it? Cut down all the trees and try to put a pipeline? Is that the kind of neighbor you want? Because that's not the kind of neighbor I want.
Fuck that.
Anyhow, so I love you all. Thanks for all your support. Because that's about it. Oh, I know, like, I'm not out here because I'm some kind of, like, adventure-seeking crazy person. Like, I'm here because I care about the people out here, and I care about this land, and when I think about love, love to me is an active theme. Love is about taking actions to protect and defend people that you love. Work for their health and their safety and the future for the little ones. Like, that's why I'm out here. There are a lot more adventurous places I could be. It's not the most glamorous place. If you like living in a veritable police state, being trapped... come on up. But also, I mean, there are such wonderful moments of delight and joy and peace up here. I'm grateful for this opportunity. And also I want to say, like, I'm not anyone special. I am not super powerful or strong or smart. I'm just like everyone else. And I think in our society, so often we hear that we're not good enough. We're not smart enough. We're not pretty enough. We're not something. I just want to say that you are good enough. And to believe in yourself. You can do it. Like, just listen to that small voice in yourself that says, maybe I can do that. It's okay to be scared. I'm scared every day out here. I mean, like, I'm way up high in a tree. I'm, like, flinging myself out onto these ropes to travel. I'm scared a lot of the time. You know, courage isn't about being afraid. It's not about being not afraid. It's about how you respond to your fear. And there's something that's deeper than my fear, and that's my love of life. And the world that I want to create doesn't involve giant corporations bullying people and then making them feel bad. I'm here for the dignity of all humanity and a livable planet and a thriving, just, sustainable world. So if that's the kind of world you want to create, like, come on over. Let's make it happen. And tell these crazy people to go back home. If If I was their school teacher or their grandma, these boys need to go in the corner. I got to give them a spanking. It's like these little kids who have grown up and they didn't listen to their teachers and they didn't listen to their Sunday school teachers. They didn't listen to anybody. But now their toys are much bigger, and it's not just like picking on the kids in school. Like, they're literally putting the lives of millions of people at risk. There are people dying right now and dead because of tar sands. This pipeline, they can talk all they want. This is how I see it. This pipeline is like playing Russian roulette with the peace people of East Texas. TransCanada can talk all they want about how there's all those empty barrels in the gun. But they keep pulling that trigger, people are going to be killed. Not just the end of the day. I mean, that's just how it is. You can talk all your bullshit, TransCanada, and you do. But, like, what are you going to tell your kids? What are you going to tell your grandkids how you live your life? Is that the lesson you want to teach them? I hope not. And I'm going to be working on something else. So, if you're ready to come around, you can come up in a tree. Until that time, I'll be stopping your pipeline.
That's what I call getting real about stopping the Keystone XL pipeline. In the wake of Hurricane Sandy's incredible Katrina-style destruction in New York, New Jersey, we got a taste of it here in D.C., and out as far west as Minneapolis, we've really got to get serious about stopping climate change. Keystone XL is about exporting tar sands oil out of North America altogether, allowing a huge increase in oil consumption. And worst of all, tar sands oil is up to 5 times as climate change intensive as regular oil. Considerably worse even than burning coal. For the Lakota today, whose lands are being poisoned by the Alberta tar sands mining project, tar sands oil is just another way to die. And with climate change and superstorms like Katrina, the Derecho that came through last summer, and Hurricane Sandy, the rest of us aren't far behind. Keystone XL and tar sands, it's just another way to die. It's just another way to die.
Oh, can we rebuild some time?
Halloween, 31st of October. Some call it Earth Night. Some say the ghosts of the fallen take vengeance on their torturers this night. On the 31st of October, 2012, Defending Animal Rights Today and Tomorrow and the Anarchist Alliance DC Network teamed up for a night of anti-capitalist trick-or-treating. The first target was Brian Maloney on 15th Street. Global Issues Management for Huntington Life Sciences customer AstraZeneca. Here the protesters stormed into a swanky apartment building. Cops showed up and entered the building. The protesters quickly filed back out another door and continued the action in the street.
AstraZeneca is a top customer of Huntington Life Sciences. Huntington Life Sciences is a notorious animal testing lab in East Millstone, New Jersey, that is being sued by the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals for violating animal welfare laws over 600 times. Eight now. Between 19-
protesters finished up at Brian Maloney's place, they marched back into the streets, coming around to the swanky apartment building housing Anita Yuloft, director of federal government relations for Wells Fargo, which is infamous for their investments in private prisons to the GEO Group. Once again, protesters stormed into the building.
I'm shopping for my way to the
place. They got it.
Oh my God.
The federal prison system sends D.C. inmates too. Rivers Correctional Institution is one of Earth's great hell holes, and through their stake in the GEO Group, Wells Fargo Bank is responsible for this. Anita! Wells Fargo is also infamous for robo-signed foreclosures.
People who are foreclosing on homes! You guys shouldn't be throwing us out on the street. You should be throwing the person out on the street who threw thousands of people out into the cold!
Oi, oi!
As protesters failed out of Anita Yoloff's fancy apartment building, they marched west on Q Street, then down to P Street, and continued across town into Georgetown until they arrived at the home of John Richardson of the Abbott Fund, wholly owned by Huntington Life Sciences subsidiary Abbott Labs.
Good evening, residents of P Street! We are here!
It's
the vice president of Abbott Fund, which is a feel-good corporation for Abbott Labs. Abbott Labs is a top customer of Huntington Life Sciences. Huntington Life Sciences is a contract animal testing facility that murders 500 animals each and every day of the week. John Richardson and your neighbors, you are not new to this.
Protesters capped off the night by marching to the home of Jack Evans, just a few blocks away. Jack Evans is famous for closing three homeless shelters and was as responsible as former Mayor Williams himself for spending $750 million on a baseball stadium that destroyed a gay neighborhood.
Jack Evans! Trick or treat, Jack Evans! We're out here tonight in front of the home of Jack Evans! Jack
Evans!
DC governor is most responsible for closing homeless shelters and destroying neighborhoods to make way for gentrification. Jack Evans was directly responsible for the closure of Randall Shelter in late 2004, where he was a key vote on a three-person committee insisting on closing Randall. Randall was closed for being too close to the baseball stadium. Several former residents of Randall Shelter froze to death that winter and succeeding winters. Jack Evans, you have the blood of the homeless on your hands. The blood of the homeless men who died because you closed Randall Shelter. Jack Evans, what do you say? How many homeless did you kill today?
Jack Evans, what do you say?
How many homeless did you kill today?
He closed Randall Shelter because it was too close to the baseball stadium. But he was also the number one person in the city council to spend $750 million of taxpayer money on that baseball stadium in the first place, along with former Mayor Williams. That stadium destroyed an entire gay neighborhood in the name of baseball and gentrification. Jack Evans, what do you say? How many queers did you bash today?
Jack Evans, what did you say?
How many queers did you bash today?
Come on.
Jack Evans wasn't finished throwing people out in the streets when former Mayor Williams left office, not by a long shot. Here's a quote from former ANC 2F candidate Howard Marks. Don't know if he was elected or not. Quote, working with council member Jack Evans, we successfully controlled the Franklin School rodent problem by closing down a temporary shelter. He and Jack claimed to have moved the homeless men who used to sleep at Franklin into permanent housing.
Yes.
But a lot of that housing turned out to be a myth. Many former Franklin shelter residents were unable to hold on to that housing and are back on the streets. Jack Evans, you are all about throwing people with limited financial means out in the streets so you can build more condos for the rich. As long as the pace of development is rapid, you don't care about the human cost of that development.
That's assault, and I'm a witness.
What are you talking about? Jack Evans, come out.
Mr. Evans, you said you're happy to talk. Would you be willing to have a public press conference to talk about these issues, talk about the homeless, and talk about the homeless issues here in D.C.?
Absolutely. But I want to bring the mayor
within a week?
But I want to bring the mayor with me.
You want to bring the mayor?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's even better. That's
good, yeah.
Much more control over this than I do.
We would really love to have this.
And I want to bring also Michael Brown, whose community the homeless is in.
And Mr. Graham, too?
And Jim is the head of human services,
yeah.
So he would be in charge. So Michael, Jim, and the mayor are really the more... So I'm happy to come out and talk.
Mr. Jack Evans, people are going to hold you to that promise to meet with community activists about bringing downtown homeless shelters back to D.C. People are going to hold you and Mr. Jim Graham and Mayor Gray and Michael Brown responsible for this and are demanding that the meeting be held in an accessible location, not in the Wilson Building, where people have to go through ID checks and bag searches to get in, and some of the people most familiar with the issue might have trouble participating. This better not end up like when Fenty told residents of Franklin Shelter, quote, "If I'm not happy, you're not happy," 1 year before shutting the shelter down and throwing Franklin Shelter residents out into the rain on that cold September morning in 2008.
Since the 2010 midterm congressional election, where the Republican Party won control of the U.S. House of Representatives, as well as governor seats and state legislatures nationwide, politicians allied with the religious right have aggressively pushed an agenda to outlaw or limit access to abortion, reduce insurance support for contraceptives, and pass laws prohibiting gay marriage. Although GOP candidates campaigning for office in 2010 pledged to focus their attention on fighting unemployment and advancing policies that would help create new jobs, they appear to have instead devoted much of their time over the past 2 years to advancing an agenda advocated by extreme elements of the nation's Christian right movement. GOP Missouri Senate candidate Todd Akin underscored this point when he made headlines by asserting that legitimate rape would not result in pregnancy, justifying his position opposing legal abortion in such cases. More recently, Indiana Republican Senate candidate Richard Murdock argued that pregnancies resulting from rape are something that God intended to happen. Your reporter spoke with Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow with Political Research Associates and author of the book Eternal Hostility: The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Here he examines the important role the Christian right has played in this year's presidential and congressional election campaign.
I think we're seeing the, if not the culmination, at least certainly the inevitable result of long-term Christian right political strategy, and that is to develop the Christian right as a significant voting bloc and move candidates into positions of power locally, statewide, and federally. And most of their strategy has been not so much in Washington. I mean, we certainly see the Christian right in the Republican Party and in some of their national candidates. But the real action is at the state level. Most of the legislation and initiatives that were passed in the states, because that's where they can actually get things done. The Congress is either in gridlock or the federal courts will stop all kinds of federal action. But when things are happening at the state level, like the old Chinese proverb said, the mountains are high and the emperor is far away.
So, Fred, when it comes to public opinion, how aware do you think the public is of this Christian right influence within the Republican Party? Certainly it's not front and center in a lot of their advertisements on television, which are sort of endless these days. But they also don't seem to embrace the Christian right, maybe as Ronald Reagan did in the early days in the 80s. What's the message the public is getting from the candidates and also the news media when it comes to the influence and the role of the religious conservative movement?
Well, I think the Christian right candidates have gotten skilled at presenting themselves differently before different audiences. If they're speaking to the news media or they're in debates, they're not going to be their hardcore Christian right self, but before speaking to their base audiences or on conservative Christian radio programs, they're going to be speaking that language. And that's helped in terms of the public image. The national news media generally stays away from reporting very much on people's religiosity because it's tricky and it's potentially subject to backlash. And so unless it's extremely relevant or they can characterize it in very broad terms, they're not going to say very much about it, period. So it's very hard for people to find out much about the religious views underlying a political or public policy view of just about any candidate.
And certainly one exception to that has been the GOP Senate candidate Todd Akin of Missouri and his shocking statements on legitimate rape not resulting in pregnancy. I guess he's got some new biological information that none of us had before, scientists didn't have. And then we have Mr. Murdoch of Indiana, their Senate candidate in the Republican Party, proclaiming that pregnancy resulting from rape is God's divine will. I mean, these statements have gotten pretty wide publicity, and I'm wondering, what messages are being sent here when the average voter hears about these positions within the Republican Party, especially from, you know, prominent Senate candidates.
Well, I think they're finding out what these guys are really like. Akin and Murdoch can't always hide who they really are or really shade their actual views. In the case of Akin talking about legitimate rape, that's basically the idea that if a rape is really a rape, then a woman biologically is not going to conceive. It's actually an idea that was put forth by the longtime head of the National Right to Life Committee, Dr. John Wilkie, in a journal article some years ago. But it turns out, closer inspection, that there's actually a long tradition within church circles going back many centuries of such a view. So there's as quack as it may sound in terms of modern science and our understanding of human biology, there's actually a profound religious tradition going on there, one that informs much of the anti-abortion movement as we know it, although it's not the kind of thing that people talk about all that much. But Todd Akin actually went to a conservative seminary, Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis, so he knew exactly what he was saying. So it shouldn't come as a total surprise. He's a perfect example of a guy who's always thought like this, but somehow didn't manage to say it. But when he does, it shocks us all.
What's the public perception of the Republican Party these days? Certainly they've had an alliance, a partnership with the Christian right for decades now. Are they fully identified with the Christian right, you think, in the public's mind? And how is that affecting their popularity? It doesn't seem to be doing them too much damage, given the fact that the polls for the presidency, anyway, are neck and neck, and the Republicans may be poised to take over the Senate. They already have the House. Is the public fully on board this Christian right agenda, or is it just a minor issue to most people?
I think people are accepting the idea of conservative Christians in politics, and that they understand that there's a conservative Christian social agenda that often goes with it. I think people are completely accepting of that. I think the difficulty is when we have statements like Murdoch and Akin, and people begin to find out what people really believe, that is troubling. But I think that we have sort of a situation with the frog in the warm water that's slowly boiling. You don't realize that you're boiling until it's too late. And I think that that's what we have going on right now. It's just too easy not to pay close attention and to understand what's been going on. But one of the most significant and powerful and potentially nation-changing political movements in the history of our country has far more political power than they could have imagined even two decades ago. So, I don't think we're quite boiled frogs yet, but we're getting there.
That was Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow with Political Research Associates and author of the book Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Learn more about groups tracking the political activities of the Christian right by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.